Penguin Random House Audio presents Gray Mountain by John Grisham. Read for you by Catherine Tabor. Chapter 1. The horror was in the waiting. The unknown. The insomnia. The ulcers. Co-workers ignored each other and hid behind locked doors. Secretaries and paralegals passed along the rumors and refused eye contact. Everyone was on edge, wondering, who might be next? The partners, the big boys, appeared shell-shocked and wanted no contact with their underlings. They might soon be ordered to slaughter them. The gossip was brutal. 10 associates in litigation terminated. Partially true. Only 7. The entire estate division closed. Partners and all. True. 8 partners in antitrust jumping to another firm. False. For now. The atmosphere was so toxic that Samantha left the building whenever possible and worked with her laptop in coffee shops around Lower Manhattan. She sat on a park bench one pleasant day, day 10 after the fall of Lehman Brothers, and gazed at the tall building down the street. It was called 110 Broad, and the top half was leased by Scully and Pershing, the biggest law firm the world had ever seen. Her firm, for now, though the future was anything but certain. 2,000 lawyers in 20 countries, half of them in New York City alone. 1,000 right up there, packed together on floors 30 through 65. How many wanted to jump? She couldn't guess. But she wasn't the only one. The world's largest firm was shrinking in chaos, as were its competitors. Big Law, as it was known, was just as panicked as the hedge funds, investment banks, real banks, insurance conglomerates, Washington, and on down the food chain to the merchants on Main Street. Day 10 passed without bloodshed, as did the next. On day 12, there was a flash of optimism as Ben, one of Samantha's colleagues, shared a rumor that credit markets in London were loosening a bit. Borrowers might find some cash after all. But late that afternoon, the rumor had run out of gas. Nothing to it. And so, they waited. 2 partners ran commercial real estate at Scully and Pershing. One was nearing retirement age and had already been shoved out. The other was Andy Grubman, a 40-year-old pencil pusher who'd never seen a courtroom. As a partner, he had a nice office with a distant view of the Hudson. Water he hadn't noticed in years. On a shelf behind his desk, and squarely in the center of his ego wall, there was a collection of miniature skyscrapers. My buildings, he liked to call them. Upon completion of one of his buildings, he commissioned a sculptor to replicate it on a smaller scale, and he generously gave an even smaller trophy to each member of my team. In her 3 years at S&P, Samantha's collection had 6 buildings, and that was as large as it would get. Have a seat, he ordered as he closed the door. Samantha sat in a chair next to Ben, who was next to Isabel. The 3 associates studied their feet, waiting. Samantha felt the urge to grab Ben's hand, like a terrified prisoner facing a firing squad. Andy fell into his chair and, avoiding eye contact, but desperate to get things over with, he recapped the mess they were in. As you know, Lehman Brothers folded 14 days ago. No kidding, Andy. The financial crisis and credit meltdown had the world on the brink of a catastrophe, and everyone knew it. But then, Andy rarely had an original thought. We have 5 projects in the works, all funded by Lehman. I've talked at length with the owners, and all 5 are pulling the plug. We had 3 more in the distance, 2 with Lehman, 1 with Lloyds, and, well, all credit is frozen. The bankers are in their bunkers, afraid to loan a dime. Yes, Andy, we know this too. It's front page. Just get it over with before we jump. The exec committee met yesterday and made some cuts. 30 first-year associates are being let go. Some terminated outright, others laid off. All new hires are deferred indefinitely. Probate is gone. And, well, there is no easy way to say this, but our entire division is on the block. Cut. Eliminated. Who knows when owners will start building again, if ever. The firm is unwilling to keep you on the payroll while the world waits for loose credit. Hell, we could be headed for a major depression. This is probably just the first round of cuts. Sorry, guys. I'm really sorry. Ben spoke first.
So we're being terminated outright?
No. I fought for you guys, okay? At first they planned to do the pink slip thing. I don't have to remind you that CRE is the smallest division in the firm and probably the hardest hit right now. I talked them into something we're calling a furlough. You'll leave now, come back later. Maybe. Maybe? Samantha asked. Isabel wiped a tear, but kept her composure. Yes. A big fat maybe. Nothing is definite right now, Samantha, okay? We're all chasing our tails. In 6 months, we could all be at the soup kitchen. You've seen the old photos from 1929. Come on, Andy. A soup kitchen? As a partner, your take-home last year was $2.8 million, average at S&P, which, by the way, came in 4th in net per partner. And 4th was not good enough. At least it wasn't until Lehman croaked, and Bear Stearns imploded, and the subprime mortgage bubble burst. Suddenly, 4th place was looking pretty good. For some, anyway.
What's a furlough?
Ben asked. Here's the deal. The firm keeps you under contract for the next 12 months. But you don't get a paycheck. Sweet, Isabel mumbled. Ignoring her, Andy plowed ahead. You keep your health benefits, but only if you intern with a qualified nonprofit. HR is putting together a list of suitable outfits. You go away, do your little do-gooder bit, save the world, hope like hell the economy bounces back. Then, in a year or so, you're back with the firm, and you don't lose any seniority. You won't be in CRE, but the firm will find a place for you. Are our jobs guaranteed when the furlough is over? Samantha asked. No, nothing is guaranteed. Frankly, no one is smart enough to predict where we'll be next year. We're in the middle of an election. Europe is going to hell. The Chinese are freaking out. Banks are folding, markets are crashing. Nobody's building or buying. The world's coming to an end. They sat for a moment in the gloomy silence of Andy's office, all 4 crushed with the reality of the end of the world. Finally, Ben asked, "You too, Andy?" "No. They're transferring me to tax. Can you believe it? I hate tax. But it was either tax or driving a cab. I got a master's in taxation, though, so they figured they could spare me." "Congratulations," Ben said. "I'm sorry, guys. No, I mean it. I'm happy for you. I could be gone in a month. Who knows?"
"When do we leave?" Isabel asked.
right now. The procedure is to sign a furlough agreement, pack up your stuff, clean off your desk, and hit the street. HR will email you a list of nonprofits and all the paperwork. Sorry, guys. Please stop saying that, Samantha said. There's nothing you can say that helps matters here. True, but it could be worse. The majority of those in your boat are not being offered a furlough. They're being fired on the spot. I'm sorry, Andy, Samantha said. There are a lot of emotions right now. It's okay. I understand. You have the right to be angry and upset. Look at you. All three have Ivy League law degrees, and you're being escorted out of the building like thieves, laid off like factory workers. It's awful. Just awful. Some of the partners offered to cut their salaries in half to prevent this. I'll bet that was a small group, Ben said. It was. Yes. Very small, I'm afraid. But the decision has been made. A woman in a black suit and a black necktie stood at the quad where Samantha shared a space with three others, including Isabel. Ben was just down the hall. The woman tried to smile as she said, I'm Carmen. Can I help you? She was holding an empty cardboard box, blank on all sides, so no one would know it was the official Scully and Pershing repository for the office junk of those furloughed or fired or whatever. No, thanks, Samantha said. And she managed to do so politely. She could have snapped and been rude, but Carmen was only doing her job. Samantha began opening drawers and removing all things personal. In one drawer, she had some S&P files and asked, "What about these?" "They stay here," Carmen said, watching every move, as if Samantha might attempt to pilfer some valuable asset. The truth was that everything of value was stored in the computers. A desktop she used in her space, and a laptop she took almost everywhere. A Scully and Pershing laptop. It, too, would remain behind. She could access everything from her personal laptop, but she knew the codes had already been changed. As if sleepwalking, she cleaned out the drawers and gently tucked away the six miniature skyscrapers from her collection, though she thought about tossing them into the trash can. Isabel arrived and was given her own personal cardboard box. All others, associates, secretaries, paralegals, had suddenly found business elsewhere. Protocol had been quickly adopted. When someone cleans out a desk, let them do it in peace. No witnesses, no gawking, no hollow farewells. Isabel's eyes were puffy and red. She had obviously been in the restroom crying. She whispered, "Call me. Let's have a drink tonight." "Sure," Samantha said. She finished stuffing it all into the box, her briefcase, and her bulky designer bag. And without looking over her shoulder, she marched behind Carmen, down the hallway, and to the elevators on the 48th floor. As they waited, she refused to look around and absorb it one last time. The door opened. And thankfully, the elevator was empty. "I'll carry that," Carmen said, pointing to the box, which was already increasing in bulk and weight. "No," Samantha said as she stepped inside. Carmen pushed the button for the lobby. Why exactly was she being escorted out of the building? The longer she pondered the question, the angrier she became. She wanted to cry. And she wanted to lash out. But what she really wanted was to call her mother. The elevator stopped on the 43rd floor, and a well-dressed young man stepped in. He was holding an identical cardboard box with a large bag strapped over his shoulder and a leather briefcase under an arm. He had the same stunned look of fear and confusion. Samantha had seen him in the elevator, but never met him. What a firm. So mammoth, the associates wore name badges at the dreadful Christmas party. Another security guard in a black suit stepped in behind him. And when everyone was in place, Carmen again pressed the button for the lobby. Samantha studied the floor, determined not to speak even if spoken to. On the 39th floor, the elevator stopped again, and Mr. Kirk Knight got on board while studying his cell phone. Once the door closed, he glanced around, saw the two cardboard boxes, and seemed to gasp as his spine stiffened. Knight was senior partner in mergers and acquisitions and a member of the executive committee. Suddenly face to face with two of his victims, he swallowed hard and stared at the door. Then he suddenly punched the button for floor number 28. Samantha was too numb to insult him. The other associate had his eyes closed. When the elevator stopped, Knight hustled off. After the door closed, Samantha remembered the firm leased floors 30 through 65. Why would Knight make a sudden exit onto 28? Who cared? Carmen walked her through the lobby and out the door onto Broad Street. She offered a meek, "I'm sorry." But Samantha did not respond. Laden like a pack mule, she drifted with the foot traffic, going nowhere in particular. Then she remembered the newspaper photos of the Lehman and Bear Stearns employees leaving their office buildings with boxes filled with their stuff, as if the building were on fire and they were fleeing for their lives. In one photo, a large color one on the front of the Times' Section B, a Lehman trader was caught with tears on her cheeks as she stood helplessly on the sidewalk. But those photos were old news now, and Samantha did not see any cameras. She set the box down at the corner of Broad and Wall and waited for a cab. Chapter 2. In a chic Soho loft that cost her $2,000 a month, Samantha flung her office crap at the floor and fell onto the sofa. She clutched her cell phone, but waited. She breathed deeply, eyes closed, emotions somewhat in check. She needed her mother's voice and reassurance, but she did not want to sound weak, wounded, and vulnerable. The relief came from the sudden realization that she had just been freed from a job she despised. Tonight at 7, she might be watching a movie or having dinner with friends, not slaving away at the office with the meter running. This Sunday, she could leave the city with no thoughts whatsoever about Andy Grubman and the pile of paperwork for his next crucial deal. The firm phone, a monstrous little gadget that had been glued to her body for 3 years now, had been surrendered. She felt liberated and wonderfully unburdened. The fear came from the loss of income and the sudden detour in her career. As a third-year associate, she was earning $180,000 a year in base salary, plus a nice bonus. A lot of money, but life in the city had a way of devouring it. Half evaporated in taxes. She had a savings account, one she half-heartedly acknowledged. When you're 29, single, and free in the city, in a profession where next year's package will exceed this year's salary plus bonus, why worry too much about saving money? She had a friend from Columbia Law who'd been at S&P for 5 years, had just made junior partner, and would earn about $500,000 this year. Samantha had been on that track. She also had friends who jumped off the treadmill after 12 months and happily fled the awful world of big law. One was now a ski instructor in Vermont, a former editor of the Columbia Law Review, a refugee from the bowels of S&P who lived in a cabin by a stream and rarely answered his cell. In just 13 months, he had gone from an ambitious young associate to a mildly deranged idiot who slept at his desk. Just before HR intervened, He cracked up and left the city. Samantha thought of him often, usually with a twinge of jealousy. Relief, fear, and humiliation. Her parents paid for a pricey prep school education in D.C. She graduated magna cum laude from Georgetown with a degree in political science. She breezed through law school and finished with honors. A dozen megafirms offered her jobs after a federal court clerkship. The first 29 years of her life had seen overwhelming success and little failure. To be discharged in such a manner was crushing. To be escorted out of the building was degrading. This was not just a minor bump in a long, rewarding career. There was some comfort in the numbers. Since Lehman collapsed, thousands of young professionals had been tossed into the streets. Misery loves company and all that. But at the moment, she couldn't muster much sympathy for anyone else. "Karen Kofer, please," she said to her phone. She was lying on the sofa, perfectly still, timing her breaths. Then, "Mom, it's me. They did it. I've been sacked." She bit her lip and fought back tears. "I'm so sorry, Samantha. When did it happen?" "About an hour ago. No real surprise, but it's still hard to believe." "I know it, baby. I'm so sorry." For the past week, they had talked of nothing but a likely termination. "Are you at home?" Karen asked. "I am, and I'm okay. Blythe is at work. I haven't told her yet. I haven't told anyone. I'm so sorry." Blythe was a friend and classmate from Columbia who worked at another mega firm. They shared an apartment, but not much of their lives. When you work 75 to 100 hours a week, there's so little to share. Things were not going well at Blythe's firm either, and she was expecting the worst. "I'm fine, Mom." "No, you're not. Why don't you come home for a few days?" Home was a moving target. Her mother rented a lovely apartment near DuPont Circle, and her father leased a small condo near the river in Alexandria. Samantha had never spent more than a month in either place and wasn't thinking about it now. "I will," she said, "but not right now." A long pause, then a soft, "What are your plans, Samantha?" "I have no plans, Mom. Right now, I'm in shock and can't think past the next hour." "I understand. I wish I could be there." "I'm okay, Mom. I promise." The last thing Samantha needed at that moment was her mother's hovering presence and endless advice on what to do next. "Is it a termination or some type of layoff?" "The firm is calling it a furlough. A deal whereby we intern with a nonprofit for a year or two and keep our health benefits. Then, if things turn around, the firm will take us back without a loss of seniority." "Sounds like a pathetic effort to keep you on a string." "Thanks, Mom, for your typical bluntness." Karen went on. "Why don't you tell those creeps to take a hike?" "Because I'd like to keep my health insurance, and I'd like to know there might be the option of returning one day." "You can find a job somewhere else." Spoken like a career bureaucrat. Karen Kofer was a senior attorney with the Department of Justice in Washington, the only law job she'd ever had, and for almost 30 years now. Her position, like that of every person around her, was thoroughly protected. Regardless of depressions, wars, government shutdowns, national catastrophes, political upheavals, or any other possible calamity, Karen Kofer's paycheck was inviolable. And with that came the casual arrogance of so many entrenched bureaucrats. "We are so valuable because we are so necessary." Samantha said, "No, Mom,
There are no jobs right now. In case you haven't heard, we are in a financial crisis with a depression right around the corner. Law firms are tossing out associates in droves, then locking the doors. I doubt if things are that bad. Oh, really? Scully and Pershing has deferred all new hires, which means that a dozen or so of the brightest from the Harvard Law School have just been informed that the jobs they were promised next September won't be there. Same for Yale, Stanford, Columbia. But you are so talented, Samantha. Never argue with a bureaucrat. Samantha took a deep breath and was about to sign off when an urgent call from the White House came through, and Karen had to go. She promised to call right back as soon as she saved the Republic. Fine, Mom, Samantha said. She received as much of her mother's attention as she could possibly want. She was an only child, which was a good thing in retrospect, in light of the wreckage strewn high and low by her parents' divorce. It was a clear, beautiful day weather-wise, and Samantha needed a walk. She zigzagged through Soho, then through the West Village. In an empty coffee shop, she finally called her father. Marshall Kofer had once been a high-octane plaintiff's lawyer, whose expertise had been suing airlines after crashes. He built an aggressive and successful firm in D.C. and spent 6 nights a week in hotels around the world, either chasing cases or trying them. He made a fortune, spent lavishly, and as an adolescent, Samantha was keenly aware that her family had more than many of the kids in her D.C. prep school. While her father was leaping from one high-profile case to the next, her mother quietly raised her while doggedly pursuing her own career at justice. If her parents fought, Samantha was not aware of it. Her father was simply never at home. At some point, no one would ever know exactly when, a young and pretty paralegal entered the picture, and Marshall took the plunge. The fling became an affair, then a romance, and after a couple of years, Karen Kofer was suspicious. She confronted her husband, who lied at first, but soon admitted the truth. He wanted a divorce. He'd found the love of his life. Coincidentally, at about the same time Marshall was complicating his family life, he made a few other bad decisions. One involved a scheme to take a large fee offshore. A United Asia Airlines jumbo jet had crashed on Sri Lanka with 40 Americans on board. There were no survivors, and true to form, Marshall Kofer got there before anyone else. During the settlement negotiations, he set up a series of shell companies throughout the Caribbean and Asia to root, reroute, and outright hide his substantial fees. Samantha had a thick file with newspaper accounts and investigative reports of her father's rather clumsy attempt at corruption. It would make a compelling book, but she had no interest in writing it. He got caught, humiliated, embarrassed on the front page, convicted, disbarred, and sent to prison for 3 years. He was paroled 2 weeks before she graduated from Georgetown. These days, Marshall worked as a consultant of some variety in a small office in the old section of Alexandria. According to him, he advised other plaintiffs' lawyers on mass tort cases, but was always vague with the details. Samantha was convinced, as was her mother, that Marshall had managed to bury a pile of loot somewhere in the Caribbean. Karen had stopped looking. Though Marshall would always suspect it, and Karen would always deny it, he had a hunch his ex-wife had a finger in his criminal prosecution. She had rank at justice, plenty of it, and lots of friends. "Dad, I got fired," she said softly into her cell. The coffee shop was empty, but the barista was close by. "Oh, Sam, I'm so sorry," Marshall said. "Tell me what happened." As far as she could tell, her father had learned only one thing in prison. Not humility, nor patience, nor understanding,
nor forgiveness, nor any of the standard attributes one picks up after such a humiliating fall. He was just as wired and ambitious as before, still eager to tackle each day and run over anyone stalling in front of him. For some reason, though, Marshall Kofor had learned to listen, at least to his daughter. She replayed the narrative slowly, and he hung on every word. She assured him she would be fine. At one point, he sounded as if he might cry. Normally, he would have made snide comments about the way she chose to pursue the law. He hated big firms because he had fought them for years. He viewed them as mere corporations, not partnerships with real lawyers fighting for their clients. He had a soapbox from which he could deliver a dozen sermons on the evils of big law. Samantha had heard every one of them and was in no mood to hear them again. "Shall I come see you, Sam?" he asked. "I can be there in 3 hours." "Thanks, but no. Not yet. Give me a day or so. I need a break, and I'm thinking about getting out of the city for a few days."
"I'll come and get you."
"Maybe, but not now. I'm fine, Dad. I swear."
"No, you're not. You need your father."
It was still odd to hear this from a man who had been absent for the first 20 years of her life. At least he was trying, though. "Thanks, Dad. I'll call later."
"Let's take a trip. Find a beach somewhere and drink rum."
She had to laugh because they had never taken a trip together, not just the two of them. There had been a few hurried vacations when she was a kid, typical trips to the cities of Europe, almost always cut short by pressing business back home. The idea of hanging out on a beach with her father was not immediately appealing, regardless of the circumstances. "Thanks, Dad. Maybe later, but not now. I need to take care of business here."
"I can get you a job," he said. "A real one."
"Here we go again," she thought, but let it pass. Her father had been trying to entice her into a real law job for several years now, real in the sense that it would involve suing big corporations for all manner of malfeasance. In Marshall Kofor's world, every company of a certain size must have committed egregious sins to succeed in the cutthroat world of Western capitalism. It was the calling of lawyers, and maybe ex-lawyers, like him, to uncover the wrongdoing and sue like crazy. "Thanks, Dad. I'll call you later." How ironic that her father would still be so eager for her to pursue the same brand of law that had landed him in prison. She had no interest in the courtroom or in conflict. She wasn't sure what she wanted. Probably a nice desk job with a handsome salary. Primarily because of her gender and brains, she once had a decent chance of making partner at Scully and Pershing. But at what cost? Perhaps she wanted that career. Perhaps not. Right now, she just wanted to roam the streets of Lower Manhattan and clear her head. She drifted through Tribeca as the hours passed. Her mother called twice, and her father called once, but she declined to answer. Isabel and Ben checked in too, but she didn't want to talk. She found herself at Moke's Pub near Chinatown, and for a moment stood outside looking in. Her first drink with Henry had been at Moke's, so many years ago. Friends introduced them. He was an aspiring actor, one of a million in the city, and she was a rookie associate at S&P. They dated for a year before the romance fizzled under the strain of her brutal work schedule and his unemployment. He fled to LA, where at last sighting, he was driving limos for unknown actors and doing bit parts in commercials, non-speaking. She could have loved Henry under different circumstances. He had the time, the interest, and the passion. She had been too exhausted. It was not unusual in big law for women to wake up at the age of 40 and realized they were still single, and a decade had just passed by. She walked away from Moke's and headed north to Soho. Anna from Human Resources proved remarkably efficient. At 5 p.m., Samantha received a long email that included the names of 10 nonprofits someone had deemed suitable for non-paying internships by the battered and bruised souls suddenly furloughed by the world's largest law firm. Marsh Keepers in Lafayette, Louisiana. The Pittsburgh Women's Shelter. Immigrant Initiative in Tampa. Mountain Legal Aid Clinic in Brady, Virginia. The Euthanasia Society of Greater Tucson. A homeless organization in Louisville. Lake Erie Defense Fund, and so on. None of the 10 were anywhere near the New York metropolitan area. She stared at the list for a long time and contemplated the reality of leaving the city. She had lived there for 6 of the past 7 years, 3 at Columbia, and 3 as an associate. After law school, she had clerked for a federal judge in D.C., then hurriedly returned to New York. Between there and Washington, she had never lived beyond the bright lights. Lafayette, Louisiana? Brady, Virginia? In language that was far too chipper for the occasion, Anna advised those furloughed that space could possibly be limited at some of the above nonprofits. In other words, sign up in a hurry, or you might not get the chance to move to the boondocks and work the next 12 months for free. But Samantha was too numb to do anything in a hurry. Blythe popped in for a quick hello and microwave pasta. Samantha had delivered the big news via text, and her roommate was near tears when she arrived. After a few minutes, though, Samantha managed to calm her and assure her that life would go on. Blythe's firm represented a pack of mortgage lenders, and the mood there was just as dark as at Scully and Pershing. For days now, the two had talked of almost nothing but being terminated. Halfway through the pasta, Blythe's cell began vibrating. It was her supervising partner looking for her. So at 6:30, she dashed from the apartment, frantic to get back to the office, and fearful that the slightest delay might get her sacked. Samantha poured a glass of wine and filled the tub with warm water. She soaked and drank and decided that, in spite of the money, she hated big law and would never go back. She would never again allow herself to get yelled at because she was not at the office after dark or before sunrise. She would never again be seduced by the money. She would never again do a lot of things. On the financial front, things were unsteady, but not altogether bleak. She had $31,000 in savings and no debt, except for 3 more months on the loft rental. If she downsized considerably and pieced together income through part-time jobs, she could possibly hang on until the storm blew over. Assuming, of course, that the end of the world did not materialize. She couldn't see herself waiting tables or selling shoes, but then she had never dreamed her prestigious career would end so abruptly. The city would soon be crowded with even more waitresses and retail clerks holding graduate degrees. Back to big law. Her goal had been to make partner by the age of 35, one of few women at the top, and nail down a corner office from which she would play hardball with the boys. She would have a secretary, an assistant, some paralegals, and a driver on call, a golden expense account, and a designer wardrobe. The 100-hour work weeks would shrink into something manageable. She would knock down $2 million plus a year for 20 years, then retire and travel the world. Along the way, she would pick up a husband, a kid or two, and life would be grand. It had all been planned and was seemingly within reach. She met Isabel for martinis in the lobby of the Mercer Hotel, 4 blocks from her loft. They had invited Ben, but he had a new wife and was otherwise distracted. The furloughs were having opposite effects. Samantha was in the process of coping, even shrugging it off,
and thinking about ways to survive. She was lucky, though, because she had no student debt. Her parents had the money for a fine education. But Isabel was choking under old loans and agonizing over the future. She slurped her martini, and the gin went straight to her brain.
I can't go a year with no income, she said. Can you?
Possibly, Samantha said. If I shrink everything and live off soup, I can scrimp along and stay in the city.
Not me,
Isabel said sadly as she took another gulp.
I know this guy in litigation. He got the furlough deal last Friday. He's already called 5 of the nonprofits, and all 5 said the internships had been grabbed by other associates. Can you believe it? So he called HR and raised hell, and they said they're still working on the list, still getting inquiries from nonprofits looking for extremely cheap labor. So not only do we get sacked, but the little furlough scheme is not working too well. No one wants us, even if we'll work for free. That's pretty sick.
Samantha took a tiny sip and savored the numbing liquid. I'm not inclined to take the furlough deal.
Then what do you do about health insurance? You can't go naked.
Maybe I can.
But if you get sick, you'll lose everything.
I don't have much.
That's foolish, Sam.
Another pull on the martini, though a bit smaller.
So you're giving up on a bright future at dear old Scully and Pershing.
The firm has given up on me. And you. And a lot of others. There has to be a better place to work. And a better way to make a living.
I'll drink to that.
A waitress appeared, and they ordered another round. Chapter 3. Samantha slept for 12 hours and woke up with an overwhelming urge to flee the city. Lying in bed and staring at the ancient wooden beams across her ceiling, she replayed the last month or so and realized she had not left Manhattan in 7 weeks. A long August weekend in Southampton had been abruptly canceled by Andy Grubman, and instead of sleeping and partying, she had spent Saturday and Sunday at the office, proofreading contracts a foot thick. 7 weeks. She showered quickly and stuffed a suitcase with some essentials. At 10, she boarded a train at Penn Station and left a voice message on Blythe's cell. She was headed to D.C. for a few days. Call me if you get the axe. As the train rolled through New Jersey, curiosity got the best of her. She sent an email to the Lake Erie Defense Fund and one to the Pittsburgh Women's Shelter. 30 minutes passed without replies as she read the Times. Not a word about the carnage at S&P as the economic meltdown continued unabated. Massive layoffs at financial firms. Banks refusing to lend while other banks were closing their doors. Congress chasing its tail. Obama blaming Bush. McCain Palin blaming the Democrats. She checked her laptop and saw another email from Happy Anna in HR. 6 new nonprofits had emerged and joined the party. Better get busy. The women's shelter sent back a pleasant note, thanking Ms. Kofer for her interest, but the position had just been filled. 5 minutes later, the good folks fighting to save Lake Erie said pretty much the same thing. Feeling the challenge now, Samantha sent a flurry of emails to 5 more nonprofits on Anna's list, then sent one to Anna politely asking her to become a bit more enthusiastic with her updates. Between Philadelphia and Wilmington, marsh keepers down in Louisiana said no. The Georgia Innocence Project said no. The Immigrant Initiative in Tampa said no. The Death Penalty Clearinghouse said no. And Legal Aid of Greater St. Louis said no. No, but thanks for your interest. The intern positions have already been filled. 0 for 7. She couldn't land a job as a volunteer. She got a cab at Union Station near the Capitol and sank low in the rear seat as it inched through D.C. traffic.
block after block of government offices, headquarters for 1,000 organizations and associations, hotels and gleaming new condos, sprawling offices packed with lawyers and lobbyists, the sidewalks crawling with busy people, hurrying back and forth, urgently pursuing the nation's business as the world teetered on the brink. She had lived the first 22 years of her life in D.C., but now found it boring. It still attracted bright young people in droves, but all they talked about was politics and real estate. The lobbyists were the worst. They now outnumbered the lawyers and politicians combined, and they ran the city. They owned Congress, and thus controlled the money. And over cocktails or dinner, they would bore you to death with the details of their latest heroic efforts to secure a bit of pork, or rewrite a loophole in the tax code. Every friend from childhood in Georgetown earned a paycheck that in some way had federal dollars attached to it. Her own mother earned $145,000 a year as a lawyer at Justice. Samantha wasn't sure how her father earned his money. She decided to visit him first. Her mother worked long hours and wouldn't be home until after dark. Samantha let herself into her mother's apartment, left her suitcase, and took the same cab across the Potomac to Old Town in Alexandria. Her father was waiting with a hug and a smile, and all the time in the world. He had moved into a much nicer building and renamed his firm the Cofer Group. "Sounds like a bunch of lobbyists," she said, as she looked around his well-appointed reception area. "Oh, no," Marshall said. "We stay away from that circus over there," he said, pointing in the general direction of D.C., as if it were a ghetto. They were walking down a hallway, passing open doors to small offices. "Then what exactly do you do, Dad?" But she decided to postpone that question. He led her into a large corner office with a distant view of the Potomac River, not unlike Andy Grubman's from another lifetime. They sat in leather chairs around a small table as a secretary fetched coffee. "How are you doing?" he asked sincerely, a hand on her knee, as if she'd fallen down the steps. "I'm okay," Samantha said, and immediately felt her throat tighten. "Get a grip." She swallowed hard and said, "It's just been so sudden. A month ago, things were fine, you know, on track, no problems. A lot of hours, but that's life on the treadmill. Then we started hearing rumors. Distant drumbeats of things going wrong. It seems so sudden now." "Yes, it does. This crash is more like a bomb." The coffee arrived on a tray, and the secretary closed the door as she left. "Do you read Trotman?" he asked. "Who?" "Okay. He writes a weekly newsletter on the markets and politics. Based here in D.C. and been around for some time. And he's pretty good. 6 months ago, he predicted a meltdown in the subprime mortgage game. Said it's been building for years and so on. Said there would be a crash and a major recession. He advised everyone to get out of the markets. All markets." "Did you?" "Didn't have anything in the markets, really. And if I did, I'm not sure I would have taken his advice. 6 months ago, we were living the dream, and real estate values would never decline. Credit was dirt cheap, and everybody was borrowing heavily. The sky was the limit." "What does this Trotman say now?" "Well, when he's not crowing, he's telling the Fed what to do. He's predicting a major recession, and worldwide. But nothing like 1929. He thinks the markets will sink by half. Unemployment will jump to new levels. The Democrats will win in November. A couple of major banks will go under. A lot of fear and uncertainty. But the world will survive somehow. What do you hear up there on Wall Street? You're in the thick of things. Or you were, I suppose." He was wearing the same style of black tasseled loafers he'd worn forever. The dark suit was probably handmade, just like in the glory days. Worsted wool, and very expensive, silk tie with perfect knot, cufflinks. The first time she visited him in prison, he wore a khaki shirt and olive dungarees, his standard uniform. And he'd whined about how much he missed his wardrobe. Marshall Kofor had always loved fine clothes. And now that he was back, he was clearly spending some money. "Nothing but panic," she said. 2 suicides yesterday, according to the Times. "Have you had lunch?" "I had a sandwich on the train." "Let's do dinner. Just the two of us. I promised Mom. But I'm free for lunch tomorrow." "Booked." "How is Karen?" he asked. According to him, her parents had a friendly chat at least once a month by phone. According to her mother, the conversations happened about once a year. Marshall would like to be friends, but Karen carried too much baggage. Samantha had never tried to broker a truce. "She's fine, I guess. Works hard and all that." "Is she seeing anyone?" "I don't ask. What about you?" The young and pretty paralegal ditched him 2 months after he landed in prison. So Marshall had been single for many years. Single, but seldom alone. He was almost 60, still fit and thin, with slicked back gray hair and a killer smile. "Oh, I'm still in the game," he said with a laugh. "And you? Anybody significant?" "No, Dad, afraid not. I've spent the last 3 years in a cave while the world went by. I'm 29 and a virgin once again."
"No need to go there."
"How long are you in town?"
"I just got here. I don't know. I told you about the furlough scheme the firm is offering, and I'm checking that out."
"You volunteer for a year, then get your old job back without losing rank?"
"Something like that."
"Smells bad. You don't really trust these guys, do you?" She took a deep breath and a sip of coffee. At this point, the conversation could spiral down into topics she couldn't stomach at the moment.
"No, not really. I can honestly say that I do not trust the partners who run Scully and Pershing. No." Marshall was already shaking his head, happily agreeing with her. "And you don't really want to go back there. Not now. Not 12 months from now. Right?"
"I'm not sure what I'll be thinking in 12 months. But I can't see much of a future at the firm."
"Right, right." He set his coffee cup on the table and leaned forward. "Look, Samantha. I can offer you a job right here. One that will pay well and keep you busy for a year or so while you sort things out. Maybe it can become permanent, maybe not. But you'll have plenty of time to make that decision. You will not be practicing law. Real law, as they say. But then I'm not sure you've been doing much of that for the past 3 years. Mom said you have 2 partners, and that they've also been disbarred." He faked a laugh, but the truth was uncomfortable. "Karen would say that, wouldn't she? But yes, Samantha, there are 3 of us here, all convicted, sentenced, disbarred, incarcerated, and I'm happy to say, fully rehabilitated."
"I'm sorry, Dad, but I can't see myself working for a firm run by 3 disbarred lawyers." Marshall's shoulders sagged a bit. The smile went away. "It's not really a law firm, right?"
"Right. We can't practice because we have not been reinstated."
"Well, then what do you do?"
He bounced back quickly and said, "We make a lot of money, dear. We work as consultants."
"Everybody is a consultant, Dad. Who do you consult? And what do you tell them?"
"Are you familiar with litigation funders?"
"For discussion purposes, let's say the answer is no."
"Okay. Litigation funders are private companies that raise money from their investors to buy into big lawsuits. For example, let's say a small software company is convinced one of the big guys, say Microsoft, has stolen its software.
But there's no way the small company can afford to sue Microsoft and go toe-to-toe in court. Impossible. So the small company goes to a litigation fund, and the fund reviews the case. And if it has merit, then the fund puts up some serious cash for legal fees and expenses. $10 million, $20 million, doesn't really matter. There's plenty of cash. The fund, of course, gets a piece of the action. The fight becomes a fair one, and there's usually a lucrative settlement. Our job here is to advise the litigation funds on whether or not they should get involved. Not all potential lawsuits should be pursued, not even in this country. My two partners, non-equity partners, I might add, were also experts in complex tort litigation until, shall we say, they were asked to leave the legal profession. Our business is booming, regardless of this little recession. In fact, we think this current mess will actually help our business. A lot of banks are about to get sued, and for huge sums. Samantha listened, sipped her coffee, and reminded herself that she was listening to a man who once cajoled millions out of jurors on a regular basis. "What do you think?" he asked. "Sounds dreadful," she thought, but kept frowning as if deep in thought. "Interesting," she managed to say. "We see huge growth potential," he said. "Yes, and with three ex-cons running the show, it's only a matter of time before there's trouble." "I don't know beans about litigation, Dad. I've always tried to stay away from it. I was in finance, remember?" "Oh, you'll pick it up. I'll teach you, Samantha. We'll have a ball. Give it a shot. Try it for a few months while you sort things out." "But I'm not disbarred yet," she said. They both laughed, but it really wasn't that funny. "I'll think about it, Dad. Thanks." "You'll fit in, I promise. 40 hours a week, a nice office, nice people. It'll sure beat the rat race in New York." "But New York is home, Dad, not D.C. Okay. I'm not going to push. The offer is on the table. And I appreciate it." A secretary tapped on the door and stuck her head in. "Your 4 o'clock meeting, sir." Marshall frowned as he glanced at his watch to confirm the time. "I'll be there in a moment," he said, and she disappeared. Samantha grabbed her purse and said, "I need to be going." "No rush, dear, it can wait." "I know you're busy. I'll see you tomorrow for lunch." "We'll have some fun. Say hello to Karen. I'd love to see her." "Not a chance." "Sure, Dad. See you tomorrow." They hugged by the door, and she hurried away. The 8th rejection came from the Chesapeake Society in Baltimore, and the 9th came from an outfit fighting to save the redwoods in Northern California. Never in her privileged life had Samantha Cofer been rejected 9 times in 1 day from any endeavor, nor in a week, nor a month. She was not sure she could handle number 10. She was sipping decaf in the cafe at Kramer Books near DuPont Circle, waiting and swapping emails with friends. Blythe still had a job, but things were changing by the hour. She passed along the gossip that her firm, the world's 4th largest, was also slaughtering associates right and left, and that it too had cooked up the same furlough scheme to dump its brightest on as many broke and struggling nonprofits as possible. She wrote, "Must be thousands out there knocking doors, begging for work." Samantha didn't have the spine to admit she was 0 for 9. Then number 10 chimed in. It was a terse message from a Maddie Wyatt at Mountain Legal Aid Clinic in Brady, Virginia. "If you can talk right now, call my cell." And she gave her number. After 9 straight stiff arms, it felt like an invitation to the inauguration. Samantha took a deep breath and another sip, glanced around to make sure she could not be heard, as if the other customers were concerned with her business, then punched the numbers of her cell phone.
Chapter 4. The Mountain Legal Aid Clinic ran its low-budget operation from an abandoned hardware store on Main Street in Brady, Virginia. Population 2,200, and declining with each census. Brady was in southwest Virginia, Appalachia, the coal country. From the affluent D.C. suburbs of northern Virginia, Brady was about 300 miles away in distance, and a century in time. Maddie Wyatt had been the clinic's executive director from the day she founded the organization 26 years earlier. She picked up her cell phone and gave her usual greeting. "Maddie Wyatt." A somewhat timid voice on the other end said, "Yes, this is Samantha Kofer. I just got your email." "Thank you, Ms. Kofer. I got your inquiry this afternoon, along with some others. Looks like things are pretty tough at some of these big law firms."
"You could say that, yes."
"Well, we've never had an intern from one of the big New York firms, but we could always use some help around here. There's no shortage of poor folk and their problems. You ever been to Southwest Virginia?" Samantha had not. She had seen the world, but had never ventured into Appalachia. "I'm afraid not," she said, as politely as possible. Maddie's voice was friendly, her accent slightly twangy, and Samantha decided that her best manners were needed. "Well, you're in for a jolt," Maddie said. "Look, Ms. Kofer, I've had three of you guys send emails today, and we don't have room for three rookies who are clueless. Know what I mean? So the only way I know to pick one is to do interviews. Can you come down here for a look around? The other two said they would try. I think one is from your law firm."
"Well, sure, I could drive down," Samantha said. What else could she say? Any hint of reluctance and she would indeed pick up the 10th rejection. "When did you have in mind?"
"Tomorrow, the next day, whenever. I didn't expect to get flooded with laid-off lawyers scrambling to find work, even if it doesn't pay. Suddenly, there's competition for the job, so I guess the sooner the better. New York is a long way off."
"I'm actually in D.C. I can be there tomorrow afternoon, I suppose."
"Okay. I don't have much time to spend with interviews, so I'll likely just hire the first one to show up and cancel the rest. That is, if I like the first one." Samantha closed her eyes for a few seconds and tried to put it all in perspective. Yesterday morning, she had arrived at her desk in the world's largest law firm, one that paid her handsomely and had the promise of a long, profitable career. Now, about 30 hours later, she was unemployed, sitting in the cafe at Kramer Books, and trying to hustle her way into a temporary,